what I'm wanting to get into is going through one of the things that came up in last year's annual meeting was talking about early church history. So that's what I want to get into, early church history, talk a little bit about what the first century church was dealing with, the environment, the society, what they're going through. We'll talk about a couple different historians today. You really don't need your Bible for this. We call it Bible study, but I'm not even going to touch my Bible because we're going to take a historical viewpoint from this, studying the early Christianity, kind of basically 0 AD through the 4th century. So the first couple hundred of years are what we're going to start going through here. And there was a lot of things that happened the first couple hundreds of years right after Christ. Oftentimes we look back at that and we think, what would that church have looked like? What would a society, what would they have been dealing with? These church congregations, what would they have been going through? What would have been happening for 200-300 years after Jesus Christ and after the majority of the Bible had been written? And I would imagine not many people know this era of time. It takes some studying and research going through that early church history and really getting a good grasp of what all is going on with it. But when we think about Christianity, there were some enormous changes. Even today, we're watching Christianity still change in front of us. And it's unfolding day by day, which is crazy to think because when we look at Protestantism, if you take the Protestants, a conservative Protestant 40, 50 years ago, if you put them in a church today, they're not going to recognize the church. It's a very different social experience, a very different Christianity, a very different religion. And so even our Christianity today, so Protestants talk about Methodist, Church of Christ, Church of Christ, Baptist, those types of churches, they are transitioning. They're morphing. They're changing. And we're seeing more and more people who claim to be Christian either becoming non-practicing Christian or moving even farther away from respecting any type of God's laws. And so sociologists have actually started to call this Western world now, when you think about all the different changes that the United States has gone through, the Reformation, the Industrial Age, these big impacts of what's going on, sociologists are now calling this era the post-Christian age. We're getting into a post-Christian, or we're already in a post-Christian age, where it is not the dominating force of what is impacting society. This prevalence that it used to be. I think back to one of the biggest events in my life, thinking back to September 11th of 2001. You know, we just are a week out from that. But I remember the influx of how many people started going to church again. Like, everybody rushed back to church after 9/11 happened in 2001. And there was this morality that they still had that's what they go back to, which isn't a bad thing, that they go back to church. But if you've noticed more recently, the past 5-10 years, anytime anything big happens, we're not seeing these rushes back into churches. Even in the past 20-25 years, there's been this huge dynamic change away from Christianity, this practicing Christianity, and it's this mindset now more than anything of, you know, if we love each other, if we love God, if we love Jesus Christ, that's all that matters. That's all that it takes. It's all that Christianity is now. And they get farther and farther away from understanding and recognizing what it actually means to be a Christian. What does it mean to be a Christian? Anybody? To follow Christ. Right. It is to be Christ-like. That is where the Christian name came from. It is to be like Christ. And we'll talk about it towards the end here of what society would have looked like when Christ was there with the disciples, and because to be Christ-like is to be an imitator. And so we'll eventually get to that and talk about that a little bit. But I want to paint this picture of what we're going to be looking at from a historical viewpoint. That's why we're not going to really touch the Bible today. We're going to look through what the society would have been a couple years, basically from Jesus Christ. We'll get a little bit after that. Talk about this time period after all the apostles had died. You know, we think John was probably the last apostle to die. Book of Revelation would have been the last book to be written. And so we want to look at this church that Jesus Christ built. I mean, that's what we're still hoping that we are in, right? That is our goal, is that we are still living up to the standards that Jesus Christ set when he was a human being on earth. We are not Jewish. We do not follow Jewish laws. We follow the laws of God. Now, oftentimes, it's really easy that we get thrown into that muddle mix because we follow the Sabbath, because we follow the holy days. I can't tell you how many times people automatically, when you tell them in school or you pull out your matzos on days of unleavened bread, they go, "What in the world is that?" You go, "Well, it's just a cracker." They go, "I ain't ever seen a cracker like that." You go, "Well, it's the days of unleavened bread. We don't eat anything with leavening." Then you get, "Well, what's leavening?" It's things in bread and crackers and just these things that make things puff up. Oh, okay. So you're Jewish. No, I'm not Jewish. I keep a lot of the same things that the Jews do, but I'm not Jewish. All right, that doesn't make sense, but okay. And you have that all your entire life. I imagine most of you had those discussions with people. And sometimes you get that with even adults, with coworkers. You have those discussions that they don't understand. Some adults have never even heard about the holy days. And then you have the opposite. Sometimes you talk to people and you talk about the Sabbath. They go, "Oh yeah, the Sabbath's still a Sabbath, but we keep Sunday." Okay. And so this, there's been this change, and we want to get back to what Jesus Christ built. We still stand on the pillars of Jesus Christ as the cornerstone of the church, and we are leaning on that foundation. That is our goal, is to stick to these truths as best we can. And so we want to take a look at this historically, those first couple hundred of years of what happens. All of these changes and the mixes, these churches that we want to look at, because there are many different sects that break in that early section. There are fragments of the churches that happen. Even as the Romans come into power, the Romans are there. They have a lot of different fragments in Christianity and all different kinds of problems that we're talking about. These problems that we're talking about today, they aren't just our problems today. They had problems in that early church. They were dealing with different things. And so we try to think about, you know, because we're in the New Testament, we don't have to deal with a lot of those old things. When we really boiled down to it and we really look at it, we are dealing with a lot of the same things. I like to talk about Gnosticism, this higher spiritual thought and power, getting away from, and there's different levels of Gnosticism, and how they think and what the early church dealt with. We're dealing with that same thing. That ideology that all I have to do is love Jesus Christ, love God, love humanity the best that I can, and that's all it takes to be a good person. You're right. That's all it takes to be a good person. You can be a great person if you do that, but that's not following God's way of life. There's a very specific set of standards that God says, this is what you are to obtain to. This is what is going to take place in the kingdom of God. And so that's why it's so important that we try to figure it out and live by that now. And so we want to look at, and we think sometimes, well, it would have been great to live in that first century church. It would have been fantastic to live early on, because everything had to have been figured out. You know, Jesus Christ would have just died not a couple decades before. You got the apostles traveling around, teaching. Anytime there's a problem in the church, they come around going, "Hey, fix this. This is not what is acceptable." And so we think, oh, okay, that would have been good. Well, the problem is, the reason they were traveling around fixing all those problems is because it was a mess at times. That early church, even that early on, found itself in disarray. It was discombobulated at times. And we think early, was it earlier this year, we went through the seven churches of Revelation? I can't remember what year's what anymore. COVID, I blame everything. COVID fried everything. All the brain cells. Whatever it was that we went through the seven churches of Revelation, those were literal churches at that time, when we talked about that, who had major problems. Major problems. Five of the seven got reprimanded heavy. Paul was constantly traveling around. We think about the Corinthian church, the First Corinthians church, what Paul wrote about and gave them a scathing letter that said, this is not acceptable. We would have walked out of that church. We would have walked into that church, sat down, going, what in the world is this? We would have got up and walked out if that was today. You've got people speaking five different languages, which nobody understands it because they're not really speaking languages. And we're going, this isn't edifying. And so it's not all about just living in that early church. For 2,000 years, the church has struggled to be in this consistent mindset of we're leaning on Jesus Christ as that pillar, as the foundation, that He is the head of the church, and we're doing our best to abide by that. Now, I think we're doing great things. I think most of the time, we are doing pretty good. There are several Church of God groups that are fighting really hard to stick to this, to stay unified in this, and to hold true to the truth of God. And we're going to, at some point when God knocks all of us around and says, hang on, this isn't 15 or 20 different churches. You guys are my church. We're going to need each other. You know, I was talking in the sermon about that 3.5 year period of persecution of the saints. I said, we as Christians, we need to be together and unified. Christ is going to bring all of the Christians together. We are going to be unified because Jesus Christ's church is not broken. Our human churches are broken. And we see it early on, it plays back, and that's why Revelation 2 and 3 is so important to us. And we watch that transition of these issues that churches have and what they're dealing with. All the way up to the point of about 95 AD when it looks like John dies there in 95 AD. That is the end of that era, that early church, that foundation that we lean on and say, this is what we're trying to obtain. This is what we try to get to. There's lots of different reasons that the church was fragmented at that time. And we'll talk about a couple of different things in the second and third centuries as we get into the early part of the fourth century. We'll look at all the history behind this and the attempt to bring order to chaos. Everything is chaotic at that time. There is a push to kind of get it all under the same umbrella, settle it all down, get some organization, get some structure to it, and say, this is Christianity. We're all on the same page. Because there were so many different fragments, so many different beliefs, and they're dealing with so many different things. And so I want to take some time to look at that chaos, because that has a big impact on what we see today with the Christianity that we have. Because what evolves and what comes out to bring order to the chaos is the Catholic Church. It's the Catholic Church that lays that foundation of saying, well, we need some structure to this. We can't live like this. We can't function like this. And so they create this central church to stop the chaos that had been ensuing for hundreds of years. And it really helps us to understand why we are the minority. Why we're the minority. We have more than 1,500 years now that has been the dominating Christianity. There are some stats, I haven't found them in quite some time to see what it is now, but at one point I know the Catholic Church was valued higher than I think any country. Think about that. When a church has a net worth larger than countries, there's power there. There's a power behind that. There's an influence that has. And all of that plays into what we were just talking about in Daniel 7. That influence that little horn is going to have at that revival of the last empire, the last Roman Empire, and why there's so much power. Not only is that little horn doing these miracles, these miraculous things that humans shouldn't be able to do, but also there's money behind it. Which has kind of been the root of all evil, of all empires and all societies, even up until today. It's all about power. It's all about money. I talked about all the laws changing. So much of our laws changing is because of who's backing it, how much money they throw in different pots, And so we see that being this huge player in a lot of the culture of not just historically, but even our modern day culture of what we're dealing with Christianity. And so we watch Paul write a whole bunch of different letters. I've talked about, you know, he's trying to correct some of these issues that that early church had and the impact that that has. Well, one of those main things is we think about what he was doing and the people that he was talking to and the influence that the Old Testament had. Do we believe in the Old Testament? Absolutely, we do. Absolutely. Are we under the Old Covenant? No, we're not. We shouldn't ever want to. Hopefully when we get through the covenants, you understood that we don't want to be under any of the other covenants because there's no promise of salvation in those other covenants. It's only the new covenant that we have the promise of salvation. Now, he had told everybody in those old covenants, he said, down the line, there's a promise of this. One day, this will open up to you, but it's not right now. That's why we understand some of these things, and that's why we see circumcision popping up in this early arguments that some of these churches are having. These Jews that are becoming Christians are saying, hey, wait, you have to be circumcised. You have to have this covenant. This covenant is what makes us God's people. You have to have this. And Paul's coming in saying, no, hang on. These issues that we have to flush out, there's things that you don't understand spiritually that God is working through. And it's not about all this physical stuff. But for them, it had been ingrained for years and years and years and years in the Jewish culture of this is our relationship with God. Without this, we don't have that relationship with God. And as we work through this, we see this impact of not only what Paul was dealing with, but then getting into that Christian church and the influence that they had. It's interesting of how they create unity and peace out of all the chaos. A Catholic church comes along and basically says, hi, get on board. And when they go, no, I'm not getting on board, they go, okay, you either get on board or we kill you. What are most people going to do? Oh, yeah, okay, you want me to be a Christian, confess that Jesus Christ is my Savior. Good, go. That was Christianity. That was what the Catholic Church did early on. It was either convert or die. That was the mentality. And so you either believed it or you were dead. Most people are going to pick, I believe it. Because it's easy to say, I believe something and continue on with your life. It really, that mirrors what we see with Islam today, at least the radical Islam, the countries that are very prevalent with radical Islam. That's their stance. That's their ideology. That's, you either accept this way of life, that this is the true religion, or you die. That's the problem that we have. That's not biblically accurate. It is not, we kill people now to get them to understand God's laws. That's the beautiful thing about God's law and God's promise is that He works with everybody in a specific time frame. We would be a very different church if now was the only time that anybody had a chance. Right? We would desperately be trying to convert every single person that we come to. We might come to the point and say, listen, you're going to die forever if you don't do this. If you don't get baptized, if you don't accept this way of life, who knows? We would end up in the same thing as the Catholic Church saying, do this or we'll kill you. Because you put that pressure on people that this, it's only the one of the two things. Those are the only two options. But God's promise, God's plan is very gentle when you really think about it. It's a much more peaceful way of acting. Especially when we know there are billions of human beings who never even knew the name of Jesus Christ. Billions of human beings who never knew of Jesus Christ. Would a merciful God destroy all of those people? I don't think so. That's not a God that we want to be part of. That's not a loving God. And so the plan of God, the truth that we find in the Bible, makes a whole lot more sense when we actually go through it and understand what it is. Skipped way down. Start talking. Get away from my notes. So what I want to do is take this viewpoint from a historical viewpoint, look at the history, look at some original sources. Anybody know what an original source is? My wife should know this really well, being going back to school. Say loud and proud. What is a primary source? It's a first-hand account. Yes, somebody who has actually saw it, somebody who was actually there. It is a first-hand account of an experience. An example would be, you know, you can go out and read 50 different commentaries on Psalm 51. Those aren't primary sources. The primary source is going to the Bible. This is our primary source. This is the foundation and the truth. Now, we can glean a lot of information and a lot of good knowledge out of those commentaries, but those are not primary sources. The Bible is our primary source. And so what our job is, we have to go back, when we look at the history side of things, is to do our best to find primary sources. Find the root of what it is. I want to give you a couple that we turn to, a couple that we can rely on, which actually have helped us. Some of these are actually really good for apologetics, and I'll talk about one of these. But the first one is Philo. Philo. If you want to know how to spell any of these, let me know afterwards. I didn't have the time to make a PowerPoint to give you guys these, but so many people may not have heard of Philo. He had a pretty heavy impact on Christianity in the first century, on the formation of Judaism in the first century. When we talk about Judaism, all the different branches and the sects of Judaism that was around, oftentimes we can think about, the easiest way to think about that is the Pharisees and Sadducees. They were different groups. The Sadducees, they didn't believe in a spiritual realm. So they didn't believe in angels, they didn't believe in a resurrection. Sadducees and Pharisees, they were still all Jews. And oftentimes, if you remember biblically, they would pit them against each other. It got some of the apostles out of sticky situations because they would start prodding one side and be like, hey, but they don't believe this, right? This is what I'm preaching. And then one of the two would be like, oh, he's on our side. Yes, this is it. And so then there would be this fight between the Sadducees and Pharisees instead of being pinpointed on God's people or Jesus Christ or whoever was there at the time talking about this thing. And so this is the impact that we have. Philo was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, and he wrote a huge book. He wrote a commentary which actually took Greek philosophy and mixed it with the Bible. And we think, well, how does that work out? It's a good question. How does that work out? Not very accurate. Not very well. And it sounds odd to us because when we look at this, we go, those two don't blend at all. Like, Greek culture does not fit with what Judaism was and how it works. As I mentioned earlier, Greek society still has its footholds in us today. With what society is doing, we can still see it. It was in the Roman Empire all the way up to today. There's this Hellenization that took place which got so heavily rooted that it has still an impact. And we see that around us on certain things that we're dealing with. The reason that Philo was so important, what he ended up doing and what he taught, is that the Bible is seen as all allegory. Anybody know what allegory is? What's an allegory?
Something that is basically used to teach a lesson. It's not a real story. It's just used to teach a spiritual lesson.
Yeah, it's something that's only symbolism. There's a lesson being taught, but the things that are taking place aren't actually happening. And we think about Lot's wife being turned to a pillar of salt. No, she didn't really look back and get turned into a pillar of salt. It's just a lesson that we aren't to want to go back to those things. She carried on as a human being. Jonah didn't actually get swallowed up by a giant fish. It's just a lesson to teach us, don't run away from God. Those are allegories. Allegories are something that has a hidden meaning. It's interpreted to have a hidden meaning or a double meaning. But it's not literal. It's not real. Now, the problem with that is there are allegories in the Bible, but we are fundamentalists. When it comes to our understanding, we are considered fundamentalists because we believe that the Bible is literal with some allegory. Where he was teaching that the Bible is all allegory with a little bit of literal. That changes the viewpoint of the Bible. I just gave you two quick examples. Another example that we can think about is God leading his people out of Egypt. That's one of the biggest ones that there are, that people still talk about today. People try to find the specific spot that they crossed. They try to find the chariots. God opened up the water and marched Israel through and destroyed the entire Egypt army. When you think it's all allegory, that really changes the scope of what happened to the Egyptian empire and the impact that that had on the Israelites. I mean, that's a big difference in walking through dry land with who knows how big of walls of water on each side of you, watching fish swim by, get to the other side, and then watch this army get destroyed. It would have had an impact on them. And so that changes how the Bible is viewed and what actually happens with it. These aren't just made up stories. This is real life events. And the problem is there's a large majority of Christianity today that believes that the Bible is allegory. That those things did not happen. You're really limiting the power that God has and the influence that God has and the capabilities of what he has if you say that all of these stories are allegory. These aren't real physical things that are taking place. These are just all made up things that Christians have seen in the Bible. But this had a heavy influence on that first century church and the impact on Judaism. Because he took that Greek philosophy and said that this is just stories that have a different meaning. They have a secret meaning. Which it would be, it's still impactful. Like it still teaches us lessons. But we want to put ourselves in the shoes of those people at that time. As historians, that's what we do. We don't look at what God gives us and say, well, how does this apply for us today? No, we say, okay, what did this mean to these people? What was God trying to teach them? What was he showing them? What was the impact? If we were there on the ground with them, what would this have meant to us? And then we fast forward 2,000 years and say, how do we make this a modern application of this? How do we still make this important in our lives? So this is, it's an enormous commentary that Philo writes, and so we see that impact. The second person that I'll mention is Flavius Josephus. He's famous for two different books. It is The Jewish Wars and Jewish Antiquities. If you've ever tried to read those, you get into it, and you really go, oh, do I really want to put myself through this? Thankfully, people have dissected them and gone through them. I always cheat and find other people who've gone through them and then verify, yep, this is actually in there. That's accurate. I was joking around with somebody before services saying, every time I try to say his name, I always think of Flavor Flav. And just think of clocks hanging around your neck. It's Flavius Josephus. And he actually, now that I've distracted everybody completely, that small group of people who actually know who he is, Flavius Josephus was actually, there was a mixed, he had a mixed reputation among the Jewish world. And the reason is that he was one of the leaders in the Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire back in 67 AD. He ended up getting captured and they took him to Rome. As a prisoner, they ended up taking him to Rome. So when he gets to Rome, he starts to understand who they are fighting. So you think about the Jews, you think about Israel, the small area that they come from in Judea, and they're revolting, trying to get their land back, trying to take their stuff back. And so when he witnesses firsthand, we talk about primary sources, he becomes a primary source of what the Roman Empire is capable of. He saw the wealth that they had, the grandeur, he saw how big they were, the sophistication of what they had built, and he realized that they were just too large. They were too large to defeat. He understood that there was no way to beat that. And so when he gets released, when he goes back, he starts advocating, saying, we don't want to fight this. We can't fight this. He says, stop fighting. He goes, we're just all going to die. And it was out of a desperation to save all of the people. Because he's going, they're going to kill us. you don't understand what they are. You don't understand how big they are. And so he, even Jews today, don't look on him kindly because he was viewed as a traitor by some, when he was really trying to save people, when he understood what the magnitude of the machine that they were going up against. And it fits well with going through Daniel 2 and 7, with the way it describes that beast, of what the Roman Empire is, of how it just destroyed everything, trampled on what was that, whatever was left, the little bit of residue, that the aftermath. That's what they were fighting. And that's what he comes back going, we can't win this. Everybody's going to die. We're all going to be destroyed. The third historian I want to talk about is Tacitus. He was a Roman historian who wrote the Annals of Imperial Rome. And the reason why his book is so important is because he tells us Roman history. But there's something that he actually does which has a much larger impact for us, especially when it comes to apologetics. This is one of the things that we get to stick in our pocket, that we can combat people who say, well, it's all allegory. You know, Jesus Christ was never really a physical human being. He never existed on the world. And he wasn't a real person. God is just creating the Savior. Like, God is going to save you through a process. And the reason that he becomes so important in apologetics for us is that he actually mentions Pontius Pilate. As a Roman historian, so that this isn't the Jews doing this, this is a Roman historian who mentions Pontius Pilate. So Pontius Pilate shows up in the records, and it's important because who was Pontius Pilate? What did Pontius Pilate do? He was the one governing, yeah, he executed Jesus Christ. He set the order to kill Jesus Christ. He was the one who was in charge at that time. Now, it's a little odd because the Romans who got sent to Judea, it was basically the end of their career. Judea was viewed as just troublemakers. They were kind of the backwater garbage that nobody wanted to deal with. And so you were at the bottom of the barrel when they sent you there. So normally there would be no historical value in that. No need to reference that or. But what Tacitus did, he gave us one of the greatest pieces of history for us when it comes to apologetics. Because what he did is he writes about Pontius Pilate, he mentions that he killed the Messiah. He killed this Jesus Christ. He's one of the most well-known Roman historians. He's accredited, like, people don't deny that this is a true account of what happened. His records hold value in the scholastic environment. And so we have this historian that places Jesus Christ in Judea at the time of Pontius Pilate, which coincides with the Bible. He was a real person. We have evidence that he existed, that he was a real human being that existed outside of the Bible. It's not just a biblical reference. There's people who try to claim that there's no proof that Jesus Christ existed. And there's actually several references, several proofs that we have. And so Tacitus is one of the ones that we can value, especially when it comes to evidence, because he was a Roman. There would have been no reason to write about this because that would have been irrelevant for most of them. There's one more I'll mention historian that you can write down. It's Suetonius. I'll spell this one because it's S-U-E-T-O-N-I-U-S. He was a imperial secretary under the Emperor Hadrian in the 2nd century. And he became a value because you think about his position as secretary. What do secretaries get? They get all the paperwork. They get everything that is written. Everything comes through their desk. So he had all of these records, all of these Roman records. He ends up creating it's called the Lies of the 12 Caesars. Lies of the 12 Caesars. So he wrote this account talking about these Caesars that are just insane. You have Nero and Claudius. He has all of this information, all of these Roman records of what they did and what they were doing. And so as secretary, everything passed across his desk, and he writes this. And so we know about them because he took all the notes and wrote basically this biography on them. And we have this representation of what it was. And it got passed down, and it exists for us today. So these are four sources that tell us a lot about that world at that time. What was taking place, the impact of Roman emperor, the emperors had on society, the impact that was on the church in that first century. As we go through this, we get to see that there's a couple different cultures that existed at that time of what was going to be happening, why so much was mixed up, because these different cultures clash and merge and blend and it creates divisions, but it also sometimes mixes in. We have that today. Everything that happens in the world, it happens to some percentage in the church. We don't have barriers that keep everything out. There is some that floods into the church, and we get a little percentage of it in the church. Now, we constantly fight it. We say, we try to break those barriers down and stop it, but it's not always successful. It's not always something we're able to do, and so then we constantly are trying to correct that and try to move on and do better. And so when we think about, we're not only taking an intellectual perspective on this, we really want to root it down and say, okay, what were these people dealing with? That's why I want to take this through this historical account of it, because we see what the daily life was like. We see the impact on society, we see the impact on the religions, and we see it on the first century church and the Christians at that time, of what was changing them and the contact that they had with all the other religions and the societal influences that they go through. It may be a little shocking, but the Romans actually had a little bit of respect for the Jews from the standpoint that they had existed so long. When you think about the history of the Jews, they had a legacy. They had a legacy. And so they had so much tenure in the land of Judea, the Romans kind of saw that and go, okay. Because you think about the Romans lasting longer than any of these other empires, the dominance and the power that they had, that's what they could respect out of this. Because what the Jews in the first century, they were still saying at that time, I'm a descendant of Abraham. That was their identity. I'm a descendant of Abraham. That's who I am. That's what makes me a Jew. And you remember and think about Jesus Christ kind of bringing reality check for him, saying, okay, I understand what you're saying. I understand the relationship that you're wanting to have, but don't just say you're a descendant of Abraham. It's just, I can raise up rocks to be be descendants of Abraham. So I don't need you to be a descendant of Abraham. I can create that. And so he's trying to teach them this lesson that it's not just their heritage, it's not just who they came from, but it's really how we govern our life. And being a descendant of Abraham isn't what it's all about. Being the physical lineage, that's not what prepares us to be part of God's family. All Gentiles are now included in becoming part of God's family. And we see that in that early church. And that's what kind of creates some of those problems, where some of the apostles actually were sent to specific areas because they had a knack for dealing with certain people. It was really hard for sometimes those to blend, for them to have a relationship. And so that's why we see some dysfunction in that early church. You're putting a people who was, it had been ingrained in them that they were from Abraham. That's who they were. That was the only thing that made you God's people. To now, after Jesus Christ coming, and Christ going, this opens the door. This opens a door that you don't understand, that it's not a physical lineage anymore. Now we know that they're still God's people. They're still going to be the example for the entire world. God's still going to work with them first before all the other human beings. They're going to be set up as that pinnacle when Jesus Christ returned to say, this is the model. This is how you do it. This is what was supposed to happen in the first place. And so they have that presence, but at the same time, it's not all about just that lineage, Abraham and Moses, and following that down through history. That's not what gets us into God's family. And it's why it's valuable to look at this early church, is because they're constantly fighting that. They're constantly fighting that. And sometimes we slip into that mindset that we're special. We're special people. We're told we're special people. We're told the first resurrection's a better resurrection. I guarantee you that's something that you're going to hear at the Feast of Tabernacles this year. 99.9% of the time, that is a scripture that we go to at least one time, if not 10 times, during the Feast of Tabernacles. That it's a better resurrection. And sometimes we mix that with, it's a better resurrection, so that automatically makes me better. No. When we look at it, God says, I'm working with the weak. Not the strongest, not the fastest, not the richest. He goes, I'm working with the weakest. And so we don't put ourselves on pedestals. We don't say that we're special people. We're above everybody else. But we say, all right, God, show me what you can do with the weakest. Show me how to be that. This is what we need to ask. This is what you need to be praying to God, especially as we're going into the Holy Days. We're going to be hundreds of miles from our home, surrounded by, in a temporary dwelling, going to church every day, looking at society that we're still working in, because we're still going out to eat. I'll tell you a quick, this side story. A couple years ago, one of my boys told me that, we were trying to figure out where they wanted to go to the feast. He goes, well, I don't know about that place. I go, why? He goes, do they have an arcade? Yeah, they've got arcades. Okay, it's a feast then. If it doesn't have an arcade, it's not a feast. Okay, so that was his standard of feast. So we're engaged in activities of the feast. We're doing all of these things, but we need to pray to God and ask Him, how am I the best example of Jesus Christ to all of these people? That's our attitude that you should take every single day of the feast. How do I make the biggest impact? And then when you come home, you carry that over 365 days a year, and we go, how do I make the biggest impact of being like Jesus Christ? That's a disciple of Jesus Christ. That's what we're expected to do. Not to say we're special and we get a free pass, because we definitely don't get a free pass. And that's what Daniel 7 taught us really hard, is that it is not a free pass. It's going to be a really hard road at certain times. And so for them, they knew who they were, who their heritage was. And we get into the mindset that it makes sense for us, because most of us are Americans. We're American. We worry about American history. We're concerned with our own. If you go overseas to the feast, they're not concerned about American history. It's Spanish or French, Chinese, whatever the history is, wherever you end up being, Indian, wherever you are, they're focused on their history. So it makes sense to us of why they had that mentality. But this isn't our kingdom. This isn't our society. We are pilgrims. We're pilgrims. We're traveling through this life. We're strangers. We're foreigners. We're going through this life trying to figure out how to be the perfect representation of Jesus Christ, so that when the kingdom of God comes, we fit into our society. That's our society. That's where we are an ambassador of. We're ambassadors of Jesus Christ right now. We're working towards becoming part of that kingdom. That's where we fit in. And so we understand why they had this mentality. That's what it means to put ourselves in their shoes of why was it so important for them to be of Abraham. That was their heritage. And it makes sense. We get so ingrained and rooted sometimes that we are Americans. Sorry, I don't want to be an American. I'm very thankful for the laws that I live under, but I'm not American. I'm a pilgrim. My kingdom is coming. This isn't it. That's the mentality that we have to remember, that we have to get into. They went through those Joshua and the kings, They went through the judges. They went through all of those things and experienced those things. I mentioned when we went through Daniel 2, you get to Malachi and there's this gap in the Bible. There's that period between Malachi and the Gospels. We don't have anything biblically, but historically we see what happens and what goes on. All of this kind of plays into that. We see how all of this works out. You can remember part of this impact is those 10 lost tribes that got gobbled up by the Assyrians. They kind of got swept away and taken. Everybody but the Jews and the Levites and Benjamin, they went into captivity into Babylon, you know, the whole story of Daniel, everything they were going through. That's why I thought it was nice to fit all this together, because this is kind of what we're in the thick of. They were told something at that time, when they were taken away to Babylon, that really changed their mindset, that changed the way that they looked at things and what they were doing. And we see that play into those struggles that they have, fitting the old Jewish culture with Christianity. What they ended up doing is, they're in captivity in Babylon. They start to say, okay, what are we doing? What are we here for? Why are we here? How do we end up here? God says, don't worry, you're going to go home. You're going to go back. You'll go back. And so they get into this mindset of going, okay, we're going to go back. We know we're going to end up back. So how do we not end up here again? How do we not end up here again? How do we protect ourselves? What did they end up in captivity for? Huh? What? Breaking God's laws? Yeah. Massive amount of idolatry. They broke God's law. And so they're sitting there going, okay, he's promising we're going back. We know why we ended up here, so what are we going to do to protect ourselves? They start studying the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible. We think, all right, the whole Old Testament's valuable to us. We need the whole Old Testament. Why the Torah? What was in the Torah? The law. Yeah. The Torah is the law of God. And so what they do is they go, we're here because we broke this. We need to know this really well. So they start digging into that. That became absolute necessity, the absolute central point for Judaism. Knowing that Torah, ingraining that Torah into them so that they wouldn't ever end up in captivity again. So that they wouldn't end up in the same boat. They wanted that law. They needed that law because they said, we don't want to end up in captivity again. And so what do? We know this. We know this. And so they start to protect that law. What they end up doing, the oral laws had already been a part of that culture. Part of their history was oral laws being passed down. But this became even more prevalent. In Jewish society, we call it discussions or arguments. They talked through stuff. I guess that's the politically correct. They talked through things. They had these oral debates. They had discussions and arguments about what it was and how to interpret some of these things. And what they would end up doing, they would debate everything. The way they got solutions was they would go to a rabbi and say, hey, this is the argument that we're having. This is the discussion. This is my viewpoint. This is their viewpoint. And so what the rabbi would end up doing, he would gather around all of his disciples and they'd start arguing and debating and he'd start teaching. They would explain what was the actual correct stance. And so they had these oral debates that they went through and tried to teach and understand and get a grasp of God's law and how to implement it. How to implement it to protect themselves from ending up in captivity. That was their goal. Not to get taken away from their home. I think we would all do the same thing. None of us want stripped from our homes. And so they protect that. And so when we think about Jesus Christ, this is what I mentioned earlier. When we think about Jesus Christ with his posse of men that he traveled around with, we think, well, that would be really weird. If we were in downtown Chicago and we see a posse of 12 guys who were all dressed the same, acting the same, we're going, well, I need to avoid that group. that's probably some type of game. That's our mentality. That when we see people who are acting like doing the same things, that's a group. But this is normal for them. This is normal society for them. And so it wasn't odd. This is what they would have seen with all of the rabbis. They would have had a following, this flock of people who wanted to live off of the teachings, those oral teachings, those debates that they would have, and this protection of the law that they had been trying to completely savor and hold on to. And so Jesus Christ taught the same way that the rabbis would have taught. He taught his apostles how to live like him. That's why I said we have to be like Jesus Christ. That's what Christians are. We are going to be like Jesus Christ. That's what we have to do. A disciple is an imitator of the rabbi. It doesn't hang out with them and do the same things as them. Disciples were considered imitators of the rabbi. That's why they dressed alike, walked alike, talked alike. They wanted to be the exact replica of that. When we look in the mirrors at the beginning of the day, and we say, am I acting more like Jesus Christ? There's some days I wake up and I go, man, yesterday was bad. How do I fix that? What do I do? Who do I need to apologize to? And so, that's why I said, when you go to the feast, go to the mindset and go in praying, saying, God, how do I have the biggest impact to show people what it is of when your real millennium comes? That's what the feast is representing. That millennial time of perfect guidance, perfect governments, perfect ruling, a perfect world, no crazy beast with fangs and wings and paws and claws. They may have those things, but they're not going to be dangerous. And so we need to do our part now, because he says you're going to have a big role. When we went through Daniel 7, we saw that first indication that the saints rule. We're not just doing this to get resurrected earlier. We're doing this because we are being set up with a job. We have a job to fulfill. And so the first part is being that imitator. That's where we're going to stop today. And we'll keep going through this history of the early church. But I think it'll be neat to go through some of this, because understanding what they went through, what that early church was, the influences that they had, I really think we already see some of them today, but I think they're going to become even more prevalent, because everything that they see, we continue to see. We saw it with the seven letters of the churches, whether those are eras, but also all at the same time. We see a continuation. God says, hey, there's patterns. All these patterns keep happening, guys. Catch on. Catch on. If we can catch on and be like Jesus Christ, then we're right where we need to be.